Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. That was Fireball, of course, by Deep Purple. Before that, a very interesting list of stuff. It's all got muddled up. There you go. Before that, we had the Alabama 3's version of Hotel California from their album La Peste. I like that one because it's a kind of shady version. I like the other version too. Whilst I can see Ken's point, I don't think murder's a fair comment to you, Ken, really. And kicked off with a bit of the old bluegrass chicken-kicking music from the Buffalo Skinners, and You Make Your Own Life Hard. Ain't that true? I suppose it might be a bit of a theme for tonight's show recently. Later on, I'll be joined once again by my friend Sine Wave, who's going to come on and talk a little bit more about return to sender and about how and where we're consenting and the kind of tricks that are being used to make us consent to doing things that we might not necessarily otherwise choose to do. But he's only recently got in from work, so we thought we'd give him a bit of a break. So I might have a bit of a rant about one or two news items that I've spotted recently that have caused me to think. But before that, big thanks to Andy and Jason and guests for the previous show. Very interesting comments, I thought, on bullying in school and how the quality of it has changed. It's no longer simply a physical thing because we have all this information technology around us. One good point I thought was made was that a bit of self-defence is a good thing to have. I used to get picked on a lot when I was a youngster, and little bit of kung fu, little bit of aikido, never had to use it. It's just that for some reason people stopped attacking me, so it seemed to work really well. And I think a lot of the cyber stuff that occurs is actually based in the real world, so if you could get rid of ameliorate the real world problems, you might be ameliorating the level of bullying via technology as well. One of the main points I thought was made that I found myself nodding vigorously to, like the dog on a back shelf of a 70s motor car, was that no one is actually dealing with the trouble. One way or the other, it just seems to kind of go on. And I guess that must be because it's extremely difficult to deal with stuff that is happening in the cybersphere. As some of you will have heard me mention before, some friends of ours were defrauded effectively by somebody who was physically present on their premises and quite popular. But whilst he was there, he was going through all the drawers and noticing credit card details and things like that. And eventually they lost, I think, quite a substantial amount of money, or several amounts of money, really. And there didn't seem to be any interest in sorting that out. Apparently, whatever this means, cyber crimes, fraud using computers, is not a notifiable offence. I'm not quite sure what that actually means. It certainly did seem to effectively mean that the people who we might have hoped to be interested in it didn't seem to be. That, you know, if you can gather enough evidence yourself and present it to actually sort it out, then that's fine. But otherwise, it's regarded as too difficult to prove. So there is a whole lot of trouble being raised there that is just not being seen to. And it's not just that. It's kind of quite physical out in Wales as well. Because same people, actually. We spent a bit of time round a farm. And there was a neighbour who'd come up from London some years ago, I think, and this also happens a lot in Cymru, is that people come in from outside and generally not necessarily the same as what makes up the local community. This particular character started parking wrecked, finished, used cars effectively in a patch of woodland that didn't belong to him, and eventually ended up with too many cars to fit in the woodland, so he started dumping them outside a gate that was used to access silage for winter feed for animals. And it turned out to be more or less too impossible to come up with a neighbourly solution, but in the end it turned out to be pretty much impossible to come up with an unneighbourly solution. You would have thought that if statute had any use at all, it might be used to remove loads and loads of junk cars that were just being wantonly dumped in the countryside and used to get in other people's way, but this apparently is not the case. The thing that brought all of this to mind, apart from the no one's dealing with the trouble, was we heard a story early in the week, a local tale of a man who'd been living for a long time in a very old houselet, really, a dwelling, and had lived there so long that he'd actually acquired the right to be there by, even though I'm not sure there was any kind of established right of title short of length of actually being in the dwelling. And when he died, there was a continuation somehow legally of this particular arrangement, much to the upset of one of the neighbours, a local farmer, who, it turns out, turned up in the middle of the night and chopped the new fence that had been put up into pieces and then took the house apart with a digger. And it's thought that it might be difficult to deal with this as well. I'll have to wait and see on that one, but that's definitely a big example of no one dealing with the trouble. Absolutely amazing thing to be doing. But the thing I wanted to think about mainly at this point of the show is a thing I was reading about in Private Eye. As many of you will know, I don't actually watch any news or listen to any of it, and generally a quick glance at headlines in newspapers is enough to make me decide that I'm going to ignore them. But I have for many years been reading Private Eye, and every now and then articles in there catch my attention, and I thought, being as this is raconteurs news, I might as well talk occasionally about bits of news that I think are interesting and important for one reason or another. And this particular one ties in with my love of the countryside and my desire to see it being used for doing something useful rather than what's currently happening in it, and keeping a bit of an eye on how it is that the insane systems we've got currently running the countryside actually operate. Then we've got, as most of you will know, an organisation known as DEFRA. I thought they'd actually ceased to exist myself. I thought they'd become something else. But anyway, DEFRA will do. We could call these entities what we like. Private Eye, of course, like to say that it stands for the Department of the for the Elimination of Farming and Rural Affairs, which would seem to be a pretty accurate description. Now, we have every year there's a kind of ban on trimming hedges in the countryside because of the birds that nest in them and the other wildlife, but it's the birds that officialdom is particularly interested in, apparently. And it runs from the beginning of March to the end of July. And I think anybody, even domestically, in theory, you can get into trouble for potentially disturbing birds at their nests. Now, apparently what DEFRA want to do is they want to extend this ban from July the 31st to August the 31st, an extra 4 weeks. And apparently this extension is designed to help reverse the decline of UK farmland birds. That's apparently what it's all about. And it would appear, at least from figures in Private Eye, and I've seen similar figures elsewhere, that the farmland bird population has dropped something like 70% between 1970 and 2014, which are the latest years for which figures are available. But of course, we know that they've actually been declining pretty substantially since the 1950s. So 69% of whatever was left, I guess. And probably, in all likelihood, I would guess that if we look back further to things like the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution and stuff, that they have been declining pretty rapidly for quite a long time. And that what we have left is but a small element of what the large flocks we might otherwise expect to see flying around us. Now, apparently, 700 British Trust for Ornithology volunteers watched 40,000 nests covering 150 species across a variety of breeding habitats in a survey that was made. And this is one of the things about the modern legislature, is that it likes to run surveys and come up with numbers and then come up with new rules that are somehow extruded from the new perceived facts. And what they learned from this particular survey was that baby birds need safe places to be for the first 4 weeks or so of life. So it would appear when they imposed the ban on hedge cutting running to July the 31st, they thought that the birds just kind of flew out of the nest and that was it. But in fact, they have to come back, they have to shelter from predators. I guess they have to learn how to fly and eat and all those other things that small critters have to do. And apparently they need this extra 28 days. And hedge trimming at the wrong time of year, if you go in there when they've all just been born and just whip the top off it, you are, as has been observed by many people who care, basically presenting a kind of a supermarket shelf to aerial predators, making it easy for them to get at eggs, in fact, and baby birds. Now, I think there's several interesting things about this. The farmers say that such an extension is going to make it very difficult for them to trim hedges before they sow their winter crops. And obviously after the crops, the sown tractors can't really work on the field side of the hedge. But I really do wonder how much difference it's actually going to make to the birds, because as you've heard me comment on many times before, and Synchro, the hedges are not what they were. In the days when they were harvested and occasionally laid in the winter months, they were wide and dense things, and I've seen renewed hedges by people who are running permacultural projects and stuff that are several metres wide and will in the long run be a really amazing barrier. But what we have now, whether you do it at the end of July or at the end of August, what we have now is persistent, indiscriminate cutting of the hedges, and doing this at any time of year is going to result in exactly what we've got. It's going to result in thin and spindly hedges that have got kind of tall growth at the bottom with nothing on them, and then a bit of growth on the top, which gets cut back to the same place every year. And we pretty much see this everywhere. So the very fact that they're expressing any interest in the hedges at all seems to me to be bordering on hypocrisy, but we'll leave that for the moment. And that business of cutting the hedges every year, cutting them back to where they were this time last year, is in itself at least a disadvantage, I would have thought, to safe nesting. And looking at them, I would have thought it might have been a primary cause of decline since the 50s, because the bigger and thicker the hedges, the more birds can actually nest in it, and lots of other creatures as well, and the more safely they can do so. But it's not just the regular cutting of them that's causing problems, I think. They use things called flails, which are... you still do see them around, I guess. These are the... not the rotary lawnmowers, the other ones with a cylinder on them that have kind of like a curved blade that spins and cuts the grass that way, rather than straight blades in a flatbed. What's used to deal with the hedges in the countryside is such a thing, but a lot bigger, and on the boom of a tractor. And it goes along, and irrespective of whether you're dealing with little hawthorn type stuff or big ash growth, because ash grows really quickly, it just kind of really tears the hedge apart on a yearly basis. It looks really, really unpleasant, and you can tell from the state of the hedges that it really doesn't encourage them to grow. And it's not like we couldn't have or don't have a technology that would do a better job. I have seen some tractors with big Allen scythes on the back, a different kind of cutting machine, which really makes a good clean cut on hedges and so encourages them to put up new young growth, which you can still get out with the Allen scythe next year. Over a number of years, the hedge would get bigger doing this, but, you know, I think that occasionally hedges really need intervention by hand. And laying, this business of every now and then, might have been 20 or 30 years ago, letting the hedge grow for a bit, and then laying it down into itself, which actually encourages it to grow a lot more strongly in the wonderful way that nature does these things. Funnily enough, some Devra-funded conservation schemes pay farmers to cut hedges every third year instead of every year. A good and experimental idea. The trouble is that, in my experience, once the 3 years is up, they just lay about it with the flail again and take it right back to where it was. And, of course, I would guess that in olden times this would have been the point at which human intervention would have happened and the thing would have been laid for another 25 years of strong growth. But, of course, it pretty quickly becomes clear that none of this has actually got anything to do with the health of the hedges, has it? Not really. The farmers were effectively paid to desist from pruning for 3 years, which, whether or not it's a good idea, they were actually being paid not to perform, and at other times they're being paid to perform. And broadly speaking, this is the basis on which what passes for farming around here is happening in the 21st century. It's what is paid for and what is not paid for that is determining what it is that is or is not done. And as for conservation, I mean, you know, that was a Defra-funded conservation scheme. Many of our hedges are, in fact, the last kind of vestigial remains of ancient woodland, and they often harbour like a wide range of native species in the hedge itself that's kind of accrued over the centuries. And at the foot of these really ancient hedges can be found telltale signs of that woodland in the form of wild plants that flower throughout the year. So conserving hedges would be more productive and successful, I think, than protecting only these small areas that contain, like happens at the moment, little areas are fenced off and then protected because they contain this or that, you know, rare flower or rare critter of one sort or another. Not only would be doing a lot more of that by looking after our hedges, but it would also connect these other places together, enabling critters to kind of inhabit in the hedgerow and maybe get from one of these areas of conservation to another, and the areas of conservation themselves could become like a battery for the kind of regeneration of the countryside. So there's this very interesting thing, isn't it? There's a kind of debate as to whether we should be doing it at the end of July or the end of August, and really the point is being missed that the damage has been being done over the last 70 years or so, and probably, as I say, a long way before that. But it would be, I think, hugely advantageous to protect and encourage our hedgerows to return to their original form and function. It seems pretty clear to me, because they make wide stock-proof barriers which keep the sheep in at the same time as providing a corridor for smaller lives to, you know, travel up and down and, as I say, live in. And save for the kind of what would be effectively a one-off installation of fencing to protect the hedge from the livestock whilst it got itself established, and I suppose folk would have to get a suitable device for trimming as well, but it would be effectively low cost because the amount of work involved in doing this would be not too dissimilar from the amount of work involved in dealing with the hedges at the moment. But they would be a lot more fecund, they'd be a lot more productive, they'd actually be given a chance to flower and fruit every now and then, and actually you could do that to them every year if you wanted to, using Allen scythe instead of flails. It seems to me that it would be easy, cheap and bountiful, at least to be done, you know, a bit at a time. There's loads of hedges, so overall it would take a while. But why don't we start? I'm seeing a lot more laid hedges around here at the moment, so somebody's presumably paying a grant for it. But it seems to me that is simply a matter of doing things differently, and it seems to me also that a lot of the solutions we might come across are like that. They're simple and they're a matter of doing things differently. And quite often they're a matter of learning from the way things were done in the past rather than looking at the way they're done now, although that really does help to encourage us to try and think about new ways. Because you see, it's not just a matter of the maintenance of the hedges, is it? It's not, because it's not actually as if the fences actually work. The land changes over time, the posts rot, people drive through them, all manner of things happen to them. And there are very frequently sheep on the road in Cymru, sometimes coming out of fields with open, broken gates. And it, you know, even with good fencing, it's hard to keep lambs in. So you've got, when you're thinking about the costs of maintaining the hedges, it's necessary to keep in mind the costs of maintaining the fences as well. Because unlike the hedges, every 10 years or so, they need to be redone. The wire might last, but the kind of posts we're putting in the ground now, I suspect we'll be lucky to see 5 or 6 years out of them. So, as usual, there's a lot of money being made from the fact that the hedges are being destroyed. There's also the interesting point that, as far as I gather, possibly not always, but most of the time, the man that is farming the sheep is not the same man as who is responsible for looking after the hedges and the gates, which is another great and carefully thought about thing. I'm sure that, you know, the people who haven't got sheep in the fields are expected to turn up with money to fix the fences and the gates 9 times out of 10. And the people who've got the sheep in the field see it as somebody else's problem, which, of course, I don't know. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. What do you think? So we've had like 70 years to wreck what we had. I really, driving around the countryside, I find myself wondering how much clearer does it have to be that no matter who gets voted for, the same things keep happening. You know, this has been going on, no stage as the hedges had a bit of a reprieve while somebody came up with a different idea and said, hey, let's do it this way. Doesn't really matter. And, you know, on that basis, do people really want the remaining birds to disappear? along, obviously, with a wealth of other critterage that's sort of clothed in fur and scale and skin, do these people want to import the majority of our food over hundreds or thousands of miles? Or for communities to disappear? Because in this process, they're being robbed of their usefulness as well. Do we want to maintain the average income of a Welsh farmer? We're told an utterly derisory £13,000 a year in an industry where 70 acres can yield just £3,800. Now, you all know that I'm not talking about the money as if... I'm talking about the money as if it's real, but in this case, it's just useful as a means of measurement of what's going on. I'm not saying the cash is actually worth anything, although it does still seem to be working after a fashion. But £13,000 for running a farm, should you manage to get your £20,000 worth of additional subsidies out of the government, of course. £13,000, as I've said before, that's what can't be much more than two people on the minimum wage stacking shelves. That can't, for all the work involved in running a farm and turning out primary products, strictly speaking, possibly at least, and potentially, and in a few cases, turning out food that people can eat. Or would we like to see kind of variety and productivity and sympathetic management, see the land actually yielding what we and our families need? Because it could yield a lot more than it does in more than just food. I find myself wondering, you know, milk's known to be a primary product, very popular, used for loads of things. How can it possibly be sold at the below the price of production if the economy is not being manipulated? In an unmanipulated economy, this just wouldn't happen. Perhaps those who register to vote enjoy being manipulated. I really don't know. Perhaps some of those who feel the need to vote are happy with the work that's being done. And the hedges are, of course, just one example. But I'm becoming more and more aware that there are many, many others that don't. And I think it really would be helpful if people realised that to vote for anyone is assumed, is taken to be a vote of confidence for whoever wins. It is. Vote for anybody and you're voting for the system, basically. To register to vote is to surrender the right of self-determination. And because we've done that, it's way, way beyond just our hedges that are suffering. And I just figure if we're going to... Oh, I'd like to have that on there in a moment, yeah. I just figure that if we don't like what's going on, let's stop giving our power to those who... generation after generation have been frankly taking the piss. They have. You can look at it and see the state of it, and it's not just the urine that's being extracted, it's practically everything else that hasn't been nailed down as well. And actually at this stage, even most of the stuff that has been nailed down is getting nicked. So voting really hasn't worked before, and it doesn't seem to be working now. And the farming thing and the hedges becomes even more inexplicable when we consider how it's all paid for. All of the subsidies that mostly come from Europe, but there are various other benefits that can be gained, but it's mostly Europe now. And those are the things that actually seem to be keeping the Welsh farms alive. They earn £13,000 and get £20,000 from government sources of one sort or another. And this also turns out to be a very interesting money-making ruse. Apparently, a £178 million IT system at Holyrood has delayed payments for well over 6 months now for over 60% of the farmers up there. And like in Wales, many of them are in the hills and really don't have a lot of spare resource. They have allowed themselves to be put into a situation where their farming is only sustainable as long as they get money from government, which once again, producing primary product, food and fuel, and they could be producing fibre as well. How has it come to such a sorry pass? And Scotland and Wales are doing pretty well on these subsidies compared with the land known as England. According to an accounts committee report, the failure of a similar IT system, which was apparently going to be delivered by some entities known as, oh, DEFRA's there again, the Rural Payments Agency, and a bunch called Government Digital Services. What do they know about Government Digital Services? It was said that the failure of this system was down to dysfunctional and inappropriate behaviour among senior civil servants. no amount of voting is going to move on any of those senior civil servants. They're there all the time, and this sort of chaos is what we've seen year after year. Apparently, in England, 2015, subsidies are still to be organised, and this means that people, not surprisingly, are somewhat distrusting of government digital services' digital system. And apparently they've gone back to paper submissions for this year, which is great, because that's further confusing the administration, because quite a lot of the men and the women in that office now don't really have any experience of anything other than information technology procedures. So you can see it's all going really well. By going along with this, it just makes it harder to, it seems to me, it must just make it harder to make a living by constantly having to renew your fences, by constantly having to rely on government that's a long way away for money to be able to do what you do. The cost of that IT system in England is apparently £215 million, and it's about to cop for £180 million of disallowance fines for maladministration, which also come from Europe. So you've got this very interesting subsidy system that's generated by Europe, supposedly imposed by Europe, and then you get fined for not doing it, £180 million disallowance fines on a system which apparently cost 215. It's pretty close to doubling the cost of a system which anyway doesn't work. And what the hell has all this got to do with what we're eating or what we're using for our fibre or what we're using for our fuel, let alone all the other myriad things that survive on, that rely on a healthy countryside to survive? So much money, and none of it, curiously, actually kind of making its way out of the bottom of this sausage machine to the people who apparently need it because they're not growing enough stuff to sell or because they can't sell it or whatever. I mean, it's down to that age-old question, isn't it? If we did what we do this well, would people give us a job? Would they, really? Would they pay us? Probably not. I don't think so. So why are we giving them jobs? Why are we paying them? The more I look at this, the more it's beyond me, really. It is, because it's not like the state of things is a secret. And it's not like it goes up and down and we have, like, ooh, periods when things are going really well and, hey, we can relax and all of that. It's just non-stop, you know. This is what it's like, because we keep doing the same thing. They keep doing the same thing, and it really, I don't think, has to be like this. In fact, I really think it needs to change. And when I had Tal Wimbush on the show, he pointed out that the Lammas project over in West Wales, which took over 70 acres of land, that's the one that I quoted earlier, that was yielding £3,800 a year for the sale of sheep. In their last year, the nine families, well, it's nine plus families now, have turned out well in excess of £100,000 worth of food in a year, food, goods and services in a year from that land. Again, that is simply a matter of doing things differently, you know. And the land is being nicked from us. I'm going to just put on a... why not? We might as well do this bit as well. Yeah, this is something I've been reading about for some time, and there's quite frequently examples of it in private eye. But that little article, it is called Feudal Gesture. One of the things I like about it is it's actually properly written. You know, it's not like newspapers when you look at them and I just get appalled by the total poor quality of what's writing. These are actually quite informative articles. And what they tell us is that last June, Lord Rothermere, a newspaper baron, amongst other things, spent £65 million buying Bryanston Estate in Dorset. I can't quite remember how big it is. And he apparently bought it off the Queen, off the lady that's known as the Queen. And it's very spooky. I read a book about the Scottish land clearances over the winter and was completely horrified by what I read. Because what this guy did, Lord Rothermere, he held a meeting at a local hotel, basically to reassure tenants and farmers and any other stakeholders, and there's a lot of them on these old estates, that everything's going to remain, you know, as it had been under the previous custodian. But he also hired an agent, a company called Savills, who, according to Private Eye, have an iron grip on the management of many country estates in the UK. So it's possible that what's going on here is happening elsewhere. In fact, I'd say it's highly likely. And there's a couple of paragraphs here in the actual article. It says, although Rothermere told the people he wanted to support young farmers, indicating there would be affordable small farms and low rents. Oh, yeah, I'm sure. It seems Savills has other ideas, viz. Reaping a harvest of dosh. The Savills agent on the Bryanston estate, presumably with the blessing of Rothermere, has told farmers that things are about to change. There are plans to oust craftsmen and turn barns into offices or housing for second homes. With the dairy industry struggling to make money, the estate is going to close all its dairy enterprises, with the resultant loss of tens of thousands of pounds the tenant farmers had used to buy dairy equipment. The farm tenancies have been put out to tender, but there's a catch. Savills has told farmers that they can only rent the land, not farmhouses, thus ensuring that a young farmer wishing to get started by renting some acres and a home can't do so. The likeliest consequence is that big agribusiness concerns will take over the land while the houses are converted for holiday lets or weekend tenants from London. Same old, ain't. But this is exactly what happened in the land clearances in Scotland in the 19th century. An agent was employed by the landlord. Those agents were then called taxmen, T-A-C-S-M-E-N. And he was employed to empty the land of people and on that occasion to replace them all with sheep. So what's going on here is feudalism. It is feudalism, as we've always known it, red in tooth and claw and apparently unchanged by the centuries. But happening now, we're seeing the further removal of craftsmen and knowledge from the countryside. Something that I was raving about when we were talking about the One Planet development is that by preventing people from setting up anything away from the small settlements we have, we are preventing lots of old crafts from actually being practiced or possibly even in the long run remembered. The turning of barns into offices and dwellings, a big thing's been made about the fact that, oh, you really can't do that. There's been limited on your what are called permitted development rights. And one of the things that appears to be about to change is that the permitted development rights are about to be extended to include barns and outhouses and all these many other types of building that we've got out here. So there will be no new homes for those aspiring to a low-impact lifestyle. And I guess the low-impact lifestyle itself might more accurately be described perhaps as a low-income lifestyle. That's what's not wanted. What is wanted in the county plans and stuff is money. We want to attract second homeowners, apparently, and wealthy tourists and all the rest of it. The idea of actually having a countryside which is capable of supporting a varied ecosystem and, you know, people as part of nature appears to be pretty low on the priority list. So as a result of all of those changes, there will without doubt be a further contraction of facilities, basically for doing, well, I mean, what? For doing anything other than watercolour painting, sleeping and miscellaneous sheep-based activities. Perhaps this is what people want. And then you can rent the land but not the buildings. That's absolutely wicked. Another clear method of keeping people with new ideas, like the people from Lammas and many others besides who would really like to try the same thing off the land, and by making sure that even if they do get there, they're going to have to start from scratch because everything will have been turned into a holiday there. And this is by no means an isolated case. There have been several cases recently of people buying titles, so they're not even, you know, real knobs like Lord Rothermere. They're buying baronial titles or whatever and then starting to exercise ancient rights. And this can mean that if a long time ago your village was built on some lordly patch of land and the village is kind of like in its own place but you have to cross the lordly patch of land in order to get to your village, you can find yourself being charged a yearly amount of money for crossing what is known as a ransom strip. So we are definitely seeing the last land grab here. In fact, it's the same thing, as I said, as going on, as has happened before. And as long as we continue to hand our power over to those under whom these things happen, they're just going to continue to happen, you know? It's got to be time to try something different, doesn't it? I'm going to put on a tune. I really think that it's, Midrin, yeah, Barnes into offices, FFS, quite so. It's not only that either, there's loads of empty farms. There's loads of places that are just falling apart, and some of them have got farmhouses and little cottages with them and extensive barns. They ought, it, rather than obstructing people from getting into these sort of things by using things like the One Planet Development Policy, people should be facilitated and helped into doing it, because clearly, if UK PLC is an honest structure, it would evidently be in their interest to do so. Unique Lee's put in the chat box, it's not a land grab, it's a land sell-off, the Infrastructure Act. Yes, I'd agree with that, except that I'm not sure you can sell something to which there isn't actually any title, but I realise I'm splitting hairs there, thanks for that. Lee, again, at its foundation level, this is simple feudal law, and it's never changed. The only difference is that apparently we're voting for it now. Apparently we are actively consenting to the whole thing. So I'm going to play a tune. I'm going to play If I Ever Leave This World Alive, I think, by Flogging Molly. And that will be followed by a little bit of humour, a sketch I found some time ago now. Some of you, I'm sure, will have heard it. By Bob Newman, I think his name is, and it's a skit called Stop It. And I rediscovered it this morning, and it made me chuckle, so I'm going to play it to you. And after that, we'll probably be back with you with Sine Wave and some conversation. So here we go, you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, and this is Flogging Molly.
Dr. Switzer?
Yes, come in. I'm just washing my hands.
I'm Catherine Bigman. Janet Carlisle referred me.
Oh, yes. Feels being buried alive in a box.
Yes, that's me. Should I lay down?
Oh, no, we don't. We don't do that anymore. Just have a seat. And let me tell you a bit about our billing. I charge $5 for the first 5 minutes. And then absolutely nothing after that. How does that sound?
That sounds great. Too good to be true, as a matter of fact.
Well, I can almost guarantee you that our session won't last the full 5 minutes. Now, we don't do any insurance billing, so you would either have to pay in cash or by check.
Wow. Okay.
And I don't make change.
All right.
And go.
Go.
Well, tell me about the problem that you wish to address.
Oh, okay. Well, I have this fear of being buried alive in a box. I start thinking about being buried alive and I begin to panic.
Has anyone ever tried to bury you alive in a box?
No, but truly thinking about it does make my life horrible. I mean, I can't go through tunnels or be in an elevator or in a house, anything boxy.
So what you're saying is you're claustrophobic.
Yes, that's it.
All right, well, let's go, Catherine. I'm going to say two words to you right now. I want you to listen to them very, very carefully. Then I want you to take them out of the office with you and incorporate them into your life.
Well, shall I write them down?
Well, if it makes you comfortable, it's just two words. We find most people can remember them.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Okay, here they are. Stop it!
I'm sorry?
Stop it!
Stop it?
Yes. STOP, new word, IT.
So, what are you saying?
You know, it's funny. I say two simple words, and I cannot tell you the amount of people who say exactly the same thing you're saying. I mean, this, you know, this is not Yiddish, Catherine. This is English. Stop it.
So, I should just stop it.
There you go. I mean, you don't want to go through life being scared of being buried alive in a box, do you? I mean, that sounds frightening.
Yes.
Then stop it.
I can't. I mean, it's been with me since childhood.
No, we don't go there. Just stop.
So I should just stop being afraid of being buried alive in a box.
You got it. Good girl. Well, it's only been 3 minutes, so that will be $3.
Actually, I only have a five, so.
Well, I don't make change.
Then I guess I'll take the full 5 minutes.
Fine. All right. Well, what other problems would you like to address?
I'm bulimic. I stick my fingers down my throat.
Stop it! Nut of some kind? Don't do that.
But I'm compelled to. My mom used to call me fatty.
No. No, we don't go there.
But I've been having this dream.
No, we don't go there either.
But my horoscope did say...
We definitely don't go there. Just stop it. What else?
Well, I have self-destructive relationships with men.
Stop it! You want to be with a man, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, yes.
Well, then stop it. Don't be such a big baby.
I wash my hands a lot.
That's all right.
It is?
I wash my hands all the time. There's a lot of germs out there. Uh-huh. Yeah, don't worry about that one.
I'm afraid to drive.
Well, stop it! How are you going to get around? Get in the car and drive, you kook!
Stop it! You stop it! You stop it!
What's the problem, Catherine?
I don't like this. I don't like this therapy at all. You're just telling me to stop it.
And you don't like that?
No, I don't.
So you think we're moving too fast, is that it?
Yes. Yes, I do.
All right, then let me give you 10 words that I think will clear everything up for you. You want to get a pad and a pencil for this one?
All right.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, here are the 10 words. Stop it or I'll bury you alive in a box!
That was Teenage Depression from Eddie and the Hot Rods after Bob Newhart's Stop It sketch, which actually is what you just want to keep saying to people, isn't it? Well, look, just stop believing that. It's not going to happen. Just stop it. Stop believing it. It really helped me out to do that. And then, like I say, Eddie and the Hot Rods and Teenage Depression. And I'm now joined on the line, hopefully, by my friend Sine Wave. Are you still with us, mate?
I'm still here, mate.
Excellent. Great to hear you. I've pressed the green button, so I think the world will be able to hear you as well. Most people heard our conversation last week and thoroughly enjoyed it. And during the week, we had a further conversation, didn't we, when we realised there's a few things that in the heat of the chase might have been usefully said. So where do you think we ought to start this evening?
Sorry, mate, I've just got a little bit of feedback coming here, and I'm not quite sure what it is.
Did you turn the radio off, dude? Put a tune on whilst you find it. Hold on.
Yeah, there's something.
Here's another tune. There we go. You're back with Dr. Rock Radio Show, and we're back live with Sine Wave and minus his ghostly radio player. Can I hear you, Sine Wave?
You can.
Very good. And I remembered to press the green button again, so they can still hear you as well. So, where were we? What do you reckon is the most important thing that we forgot to talk about when we were doing our return to sender chat last week? Where would you want to start this week?
Oh, the most important thing. I don't know what the most important thing is, but I suppose there was a few things that we we could have covered, time permitting. Just looking at my notes, there was Freud's id, or the id complex, which you probably come across.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I was interested to see you bring that up.
Yeah, well, obviously the id is the identity. And, you know, when you tie that in with the person, i.e. identifying the person, it, you know, it becomes quite interesting.
Because he used I believe, the words I and it for ego and id in German. It was only his translator who decided they needed to go into the Latin.
That's right. It was called the id or the it.
Right.
And that gets really interesting because the definition of it is used to identify a person.
Where did you get that definition from? That's a new one on me as well.
Can't remember where, but I put it into a Google translation, and I read several different translations, and it came up as quite often id stroke it. Id, i.e. it, whatever. And then I looked at the definition of the word it, and I can't think where it come from, but it come up used to identify a person, which I thought was so interesting, bearing in mind what we talked about last week about the word person.
Yes, yeah, which you might just remind us about in case there's anybody new out there.
Well, the person, I mean, we go to the interpretation, if we want a legalese interpretation, we go to the Interpretation Act 1978, and it interprets the word person as includes a body of persons, corporate or unincorporate. And I think we broke that down, you know, the body of person. Well, first of all, how can a man or woman be a body of persons? They can't, logically, they can't. There has to be something that's attached to that. And my theory is that when a man or woman accepts the name, the identity, that's what forms the body, with the corporate body, i.e. the name.
Yep, that's right. And that means that when we look at legislation, we notice it applies to the person, and the person is a corporate body of some sort. So unless you're a corporate body, it possibly doesn't apply to you.
No, it doesn't apply to us. As long as we know who we are, it doesn't apply to us. But the another interesting point was people have... associated the all caps name with the person. And what's commonly quoted is a Roman term, capitis diminutio, which is, it's sort of done the rounds on the Freeman circuit, get out debt free, etc. And most people interpret the term capitis diminutio with being the loss of legal status. But when we break the words down, we look at the etymology of the two different words, we find that capitis means off the head. Diminutio means like to diminish, it's the loss. So when we combine that, that's the loss of the head. So we can break that down and look at it, what emanates from the head. Well, we would popularly say consciousness. Thought comes from the head. So when we break that word down and we redefine it, it actually means a loss of consciousness. And that's referring to the use of all caps in our name, which I thought was quite telling.
Yes, I remember listening to Simon Spaniard when he was there, because I often wondered whether there was a distinction between the name of the person with just the capital letters at the beginning of it, or when it turns up in all capital letters, or fully capped, as they say. And I remember hearing Simon Spaniard saying that all capital letters basically means full slave mode.
Well, it's not grammatically correct. And if you go to the Oxford Styles Manual, which is the governing book of the English language, you find that all caps, or what's called gloss or glossa, It's not found within there. It's seen as being a foreign language named Ancient Latin. And, you know, from that we will see, you know, there's uppercase is not recognised. It's recognised as used on you know, when people are dead on people's gravestones, i.e., you know, a dead fictional entity. But looking at the term gloss or glosser, I was looking at the definition of gloss, and that was quite telling. It's a superficial attractive appearance of inversion, and it's trying to conceal or disguise something unfavourable, a superficial luster or shine, which I thought was quite telling.
Yeah, superficial attractive appearance, we know all about that, don't we? So we're saying that, I mean, what, just exactly, until I spoke to you, I hadn't heard of this Oxford Styles manual governing the English language. Just exactly what is it? Where do you find that?
Well, to be honest, I'll give credit to someone whose name, or I would give credit if I could remember the guy's name who posted this recently, and I can't remember his name, so I can't credit him. But a guy came up with this this information. This has only been within the past week, and I downloaded a recent PDF, which is the Oxford Styles Manual. And I looked there for any all caps definitions, etc., and it wasn't in there. So I'm sort of borrowing heavily, admittedly, from some of his material, although I've researched some of it and what he said as so far, you know, it's come into fruition, it's true. I've been in contact with him. I'm waiting for a response from him to get some more information, but it's pretty interesting, certainly from what I've discovered so far, thanks to this guy. Like I say, I would credit him, but I just can't remember his name.
Maybe it'll come back to you before the end of the show.
It will, Dom.
So we're saying that there's some sort of connection between all capital letters and a foreign language known as Ancient Latin.
Yeah, that's what it appears, yeah. Yeah, and like I say, I've not done enough research to uncover that. I'm relying on this guy's information, so this, you know, this is circumstantial at present. But certainly, I mean, if I'd looked into it and I'd found that it's not grammatically correct to use all caps.
No, indeed. It's not even correct in chat boxes, is it? Because people accuse you of shouting at them.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, this is something I did years ago. I looked into it and I found out where it's not grammatically correct to use all caps. So it resonates. The information this guy has found out resonates. I've not yet proven it to be true, but it appears to me to be pretty, at the moment, it's circumstantial. But I've got a hunch that what he's found out is probably pretty much true.
It is interesting, I think, that, you know, when we're taught to write, one of the first things we're taught is to capitalise the I. And the next, one of the other things we're taught at the very beginning is that you don't, as you say, you just don't use all capital letters in a row. And yet when our person is being addressed through a window in an envelope, it's not always all capital letters, but it quite often is. And that does stir an interest, doesn't it?
Yeah, and certainly you just said this just really resonated when you said that you're taught to capitalise the word I. So if we think about the word I in its uncapitalised form, what does it represent?
I'd say it represents a man with a head on his shoulders.
Exactly. It's a line with a dot above it, which represents our consciousness that is above our, you know, our human body. Which, you know, states to me that our consciousness is above our physical self. And to capitalise it takes that away from us.
Yes, that's right. It's, the capitalisation, I think, is representative of somebody who's had the head removed from his shoulders. I think it was Simon Spaniard who pointed out that it's also possible that the capitalised I actually looks like... looks like a gallows from which one might well hang oneself.
Well, it's funny what you just said there. earlier perfectly rates to the definition of capitis diminutio, i.e. the loss of head, which we just went into.
Yes, yes, that's the topic.
And you just perfectly gave an example of that in your explanation there.
And there you go. The first thing they teach you to do is to chop your own head off and represent yourself everywhere as somebody who's not thinking.
Exactly. Which, that's brilliant, Nick.
that kind of brings us back to the to Freud's id and ego as well, because if the id, which of course with a couple of dots in it is ID, is it, which is used to, as you say, identify a person, and the ego is like I, it was one of the things that Freud wrote, apparently, was where the ego was, or where it was, there the ego will be. And what he meant was, where it was, there I will be. And that's very much what we're talking about here, isn't it? Because at the moment, if you don't pay any attention, it is the it that's there. It's the ID, it's the person, it's the all capital name. And what we're after doing is actually putting the I with the dot over it there, putting the thinking man in the place, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, the definition of the id is a primitive and instinctual behaviour of the personality. So what you just said there is, I mean, that's bang on, because it's the primitive and instinctual behaviour of the personality, i.e. the R complex of the brain. You know, we're talking about the reptilian part of the brain, which is personified by the colour red. You know, when we think of terms like, you know, red rag to a bull, seeing red, the lady in red. If you look at the Tree of Life in Kabbalah, Malkuth, which is the bottom, there's 10 Sephiroth in the Tree of Kabbalah. You know, it's a glyph that's given in the Tree of Life. And you'll find that it's coloured red. If you look at I'm losing my track. Oh, I'm full of cold here, so
that's all right. We were on about the reptilian complex and the Kabbalah.
Yeah, sorry, I'm full of cold here, so I'm struggling at the moment. But when we look at the spheres in our body, you have to help me out here, Nick.
The cells.
No, the spheres.
The chakras.
Sorry, yeah, the chakras in our body. When you look at the bottom chakra, which is from the generative region, and you'll see that it's coloured red. Red is the lowest vibratory colour, so it's seen as being the correspondence that comes from our personal instincts, our primitive behavioural patterns. And when you look at the corporate logos, and you'll see anything that appears to our instinctual behaviour, like our eating patterns, you know, our lust for food, whatever. So we look at McDonald's, we can look at Coca-Cola, we can look at Budweiser, we can look at Burger King, etc. They're all coloured red.
Yeah.
And it's funny, when the game was up with McDonald's, when people started to realise this is, you know, this is chemical shite, in the middle class areas where they generally had realised this stuff is shit, McDonald's changed its colours of its I use this term sparingly, its restaurants. It started to use the colours red and brown, green and brown. And of course these are very earthly colours, and it was trying to convince the public via those colours that this stuff is okay to eat. This is earthly. You know, the some of the most prominent colours on earth obviously are green and brown. You know, they're not red. The red colour went to our instinctual whims, you know, to go and eat this chemical shit food. But the more affluent areas, the areas where people thought a bit more, they had to colour them green and brown.
I can't help finding myself wondering whether that had actually worked with something such as McDonald's. Do you think? I suppose probably can draw more people in just by making the signs green. It's a bit depressing, but...
Well, it's funny. I mean, I don't think we often realise how much we take in by the use of colour. You know, when you think about the, you know, our consciousness, what we experience, it's like we don't always acknowledge that or aware of the fact that we are tied into, you know, our five senses. And one of the senses that we pick up on, you know, so a vibratory instinct that we pick up on is colour. But, of course, we don't pick up on it consciously. So when McDonald's changed their colours to brown and green, we don't instinctively or consciously know that we're picking up on it, but subconsciously we do. And the more conscious we get... You know, the less we, or the more we realise that it's bullshit. But to the masses, you know, they see these colours and they won't consciously pick up. It's a subconscious thing that it's picking up on. But they recognise these colours and they associate them with certain things. That's why we see sun symbols on, you know, corporate entities. God, I was looking at a packet of crisps today that my wife had bought me. And they're meant to be, I can't think what they were called, but it was something sun, you know, they were actually Walker's crisps, but it was sun something. And I said to my wife, look at the advertising, you know, they're still full of shit. If you read the ingredients, they're still full of shit. But the very fact that they're called sun, we'll look at them and immediately we look at the sun as being the source of energy, of vital life force. You know, we're warmed by the sun, crops grow by the sun, we know we need the sun to survive, we know the sun makes us smile, particularly, you know, over here in Britain. Yeah,
on the odd occasion we see it.
Yeah, of course. And immediately, you know, it's a subconscious thing. We don't consciously pick up on the fact that they've used the sun in the wording, but subconsciously we pick up on it and we think this is good for us, but it's still the same shit. There's still crap in there. Mm.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true about colour as well, because I'm aware there's at least two or three modalities of kind of colour therapy that hold that different levels of colour have different effects on our consciousness. And I've certainly noticed, I mean, I don't know whether it's a rule with Powys County Council, but they all seem to dress in a variety of black and white. You know, might be dog tooth, might be stripes, but by and large, they're mostly dressed in black and white. And I've noticed that since I started wearing bright colours consciously, it kind of changes people's reactions to you. So I guess it probably would work in advertising too.
Oh, it certainly does. I mean, that's interesting. You said they're black and white. That's like the tesserated checkerboard floor of a Masonic temple, isn't it? Or an Egyptian temple.
Do you suppose they actually suspect who they're working for subconsciously?
They're probably not consciously, other than the higher levels. But, I mean, you know, the black and white tesserated floor goes back to, you know, centuries to... Egyptian and Greek temples would use a black and white tesserated floor that symbolizes walking between light and darkness. It's someone who is, you know, initiate, who is spiritually inept, and they're walking between light and dark, but they're on the path to find, you know, divinity, to climb Jacob's ladder. And you know, to find themselves spiritually.
Yeah, I wonder if that's happening very much in the Powys County Council. I doubt it somehow. Just to return a minute to I want to return just for a moment to the all capital letters, because something that occurred to me as you were talking is the fact that I believe that if you're not using all capital letters, if you're using, because one of the things we were taught at school fair, once we got the capital letters sorted, we were taught quickly how to join our writing up, weren't we? And it only occurred to me recently that that's actually called cursive.
Oh, really?
That writing is called cursive. Yeah. So we've got all block capitals that are a foreign language called ancient Latin, and the language that we otherwise use is called cursive, which I think, given that every word's a spell, is totally brilliant.
That's awesome, Nick. yeah, it is a curse.
Yeah, I know something else you wanted to mention, and I'd forgotten about it as well, was the case of a mate of yours. If we return to the return to sender and the especially the kind of withdrawal of consent subject, a mate of yours has basically got a YouTube, hang on, I can probably, there it is. It's called Driving Without Insurance or Tax, Refusal to Give Samples, Released Without Charge. I've just posted the link into the chat, but do you want to say a few words about that? Because it's a stunning tale.
Yeah, it's awesome. And this is one of the most valuable bits of information, I think. And the whole story is interesting because if I start from the beginning, Simon Spanning was doing a workshop in Milton Keynes that I'd organised. And Dave Goins had come along, Dave's from Peterborough, so it's quite a distance from Milton Keynes, probably about an hour and a quarter, hour and a half away. Dave had been to quite a few of the meetings that we'd had and the people that we'd have giving talks, etc. And he came along to Simon's workshop, and after we'd go down the pub, and Dave came along to the pub, and Dave probably had a few too many to legally drive home.
Which isn't very many, is it?
No, not many at all. But anyways, Dave drove off. But this was on a Saturday. And I think it was on the Monday or the Tuesday. Dave sent me a message on Skype, and he said, oh, I've got Nick's driving home on the Saturday, just outside my house. And I said, all right, what happened then? And he sort of, you know, gave me the details of what had happened. And he said, I didn't consent to anything. They nicked me, you know, they took me to the police station. I didn't consent to anything. He sent me some paperwork a few days later that said that basically all the claims that the police had made had been dropped. And I think it was probably about 6 months later, someone sent me a video, and it's the video that you've just posted, and I watched it, and I thought, hold on, that's Dave. And now, I think this was on, I think it was UK TV.
It was a satellite TV channel or some sort.
Yeah, it was a satellite TV channel. And I watched it, and I thought, hold on, that's Dave. So I sent Dave it. I recognised his van. I recognised Dave, even though his face was blotted out. But I sent it to him just for him to confirm, and he came back and said, yeah, that's me. And there it is in full view. Dave had no insurance. He had no tax. His vehicle was not MOT'd.
He refused to give him samples.
Exactly. Refused everything. He didn't consent. They had to drag him out of the car. he also relied on his claim of right, and I think it was £1 million fee schedule that he claimed.
Did he ever make any money out of them?
No, he never got anywhere with that. He did try it, but he never got anywhere. But he didn't really carry it on, to be fair. He sort of said he gave it a token gesture, but I don't think he was ever going to get anywhere with that.
I was wondering about the bit where he insisted, you know, you'll find it in my claim of right, you'll find it in my claim of right. He would have been just as all right to say nothing, wouldn't he?
Of course, without doubt. I don't think the claim of right is what did it.
No.
For me, it was the non-compliance. As an interesting side note, I went down to the pub tonight after work, and there was a group of us got together, and there's a guy that's been joining us, and someone told me, the last couple of months this guy's been joining us, and someone said to me, he said, you know his drug squad, didn't you? Milton Keynes drug squad. I said, no, I didn't. Anyway, I got chatting to this guy, and he openly admitted he was Milton Keynes drug squad. And it was quite interesting because recent events, a couple of guys or a few guys that I know recently went down for, you know, sort of large-scale drug dealing. This guy was involved. And we got in a chat and we were chatting about it. And I knew people that he knew, etc. And he seems like a quite cool chap, but of course he's a police officer. So, but anyways, we got discussing the whole name game thing. And he was telling me that he used to be a desk sergeant. I said, so, okay, how would you deal with someone who came up there that wasn't prepared to give you a name? And more importantly, has anyone ever refused to give you a name? He said, no, in all my times as desk sergeant, everyone always gave their name. I said, oh, that's quite interesting. So what would you do if someone didn't? And he was umming and ahhing, and he said, oh, But he gave me some interesting information. He said, if it wasn't a crime that was up to a year, potentially up to a year in prison, he wouldn't bother with it. So I said, so that person would be let go? And he said, basically, yes. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, so how would you proceed if you perceived it was someone who potentially might have done a year or so in prison? He said, well, I'd have him in court the next day. I said, okay, who would you have in court? And he said, well, they would go under the term of no name. And I said, well, how would the court proceed? He said, well, that's outside of me. You know, I wouldn't deal with that. So I said, well, how do you think it would pan out? And he said, well, to be honest, I'm totally unaware. But it was an interesting conversation it was a nice insight into how the other side, maybe should I say, you know, I don't know if that's maybe the correct way to view it, but the other side may view it. And he did actually state, he said, if I come up against someone like you, I wouldn't have a fucking clue how to deal with you.
Mm. Well, because there is no way to deal with a man under those circumstances. And I think commonly known as Dom was in fact taken to court after he hadn't given him a name or an address or anything, and he was bailed to reappear, and it actually said on the documentation they gave him, it said no name given, no address given.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm convinced that's the way it pan out. And like we were referring to you referred earlier to the post that I sent you about the alleged protesters that refused to give their names to the police and refused to give their names in court, and they were released without charge.
Yes, and that is the point, isn't it? That's ultimately the point about... excuse me, Mo. Got a good cough there. That's ultimately the point about your mate Dave, is that... That he was, he didn't have any tax, didn't have any insurance, was probably over the limit. He kind of, he put his legs around the handbrake and his arms around the steering wheel, and they kind of more or less literally had to prise him out of there. He wouldn't give him his name, he wouldn't change into the paper safety trousers. They had to, and it was really brilliant because they went through all of this stuff and they said the man was released the following morning without charge. And basically, it is down to not acknowledging the name, but it's also down to how you act, isn't it? It's not just the name. You need not to comply.
Exactly. I mean, Dave's someone who's, been downtrodden. He's dealt within the criminal world. He's used to dealing with the police. And, most people would buckle. Funny enough, when I was talking, I was telling you earlier, when I was talking to the policeman tonight, there was a girl there who sat there who was a council worker, and she said, when I was talking about the whole name game stuff, and she said to me, she said, but I am the name. And I said, well, I can clearly demonstrate you're not the name. And I went through the procedure of saying, right, you give them name down on a piece of paper, hold it up and ask yourself the question, is that you? And she kept saying, yeah. And I point at her body and I say, well, who are you? And she said, but I'm still the name. I said, well, how can you be both? How can you be words on a piece of paper and that vehicle? And she said, I don't get it. Well, interestingly, the copper got it straight away and was laughing. And he said, I get it, I get it. And he got it straight away. But this girl couldn't get it. And I was trying to baby walk her through it. And she couldn't get it. And this shows the trap. This shows the occult trap. And it's so, so simple that most people just don't get it. And it is convincing people that they're a name. And she was absolutely oblivious to the fact that she couldn't be a name, that she was a name, that was her. No matter how I attempted to demonstrate that she wasn't a name, she wasn't willing to admit that, to see logic. And she just kept agreeing, no, I am the name, that's me,
I wonder if she'd found it any easier to deal with the idea that she was a corporated body.
Well, I did explain that. I was explaining that, do you realise that the name is a corporate entity? And I felt that I clearly demonstrated that to her, and she still said, but I don't get it, you know, I am me. And I said, well, who is me? And she said, well, I am. And she said her name. I said, but that's merely the vocalized expression of a sound. How does that define you? And she couldn't get it.
In what sense is it the name that's doing any of the thinking or the talking here? Is it, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? I've not come across anybody who's found it difficult to swallow that one. And I'm not surprised that your desk sergeant knew about it, because I think they know about the whole game. It is amazing, though, isn't it, that at no stage in his career did anybody turn up and try to remain silent and not give the name. Everybody's told you have the right to remain silent, and he's effectively telling us that nobody ever did that.
Well, this is what was interesting. I told him, I gave an account of when I was a youngster, I was a teenager, and our local Bobby had arrested me, and this is when it first, someone had given me sort of the heads up, to be fair, but it hit me when this guy said, read out the arresting statement, and and he said, you have the right to remain silent, anything you say may be used as evidence against you. And immediately I pulled him up and I said, well, hold on, you just said I have a right to remain silent. Well, maybe I will withhold that right. And you did say that anything I say may be used as evidence against me, so why would I tell you anything? And immediately the guy, this drug squad officer, you know, former desk sergeant, he started laughing. And I said, what are you laughing at? He said, God, I'd never really thought of that. And I said, did no one ever say that to you? And he said, no. And he actually knew the guy, the copper that I was talking about that arrested me as a teenager. And he said, you know, he said, God, he said, he must have had a, you know, problem dealing with you. I said, well, he did, because I used to get let go, you know, because they couldn't deal with you. And this was proof of it. And like you say, with Dave's video, which further reiterates what we've been saying, and with the case of the alleged protesters in London that were let free, all three of them, again, this further reiterates what we've been saying, is that the whole thing is a name game. They're trying to attract the entity, and once you don't subscribe to the entity, they've got nothing to go on.
That's right. And as uniquely he's put in the chat room, he's put, the arresting constable should have prima facie evidence that he or some other has witnessed a crime, i.e. harm, loss or damage. On the subject of which, I'm interested at the fact that your desk sergeant, somewhat arbitrarily, I would have thought, said, well, you know, if I thought what he was in for might carry a sentence of a year or more, then I wouldn't necessarily have let him go. But if the guy didn't, I mean, well, for a start off, if it's an actual crime, i.e. if he's caused harm, loss or damage, then withholding the name and stuff isn't going to work, because you are guilty and you need to make amends, basically. But
yep.
If running through his mind was, you know, a possible year for a legislative offence, for an offence against the legislature, then you're talking about something that's civil, which, unless it's converted to criminal, can't possibly carry a charge or any prison time. I wonder what he was thinking.
Well, we had this conversation, and I said exactly what you just said there. And I said, anyone who's committed a crime that's harmed someone in any way, shape or form, you know, I believe they deserve what they've got coming. However, you know, when it's a statutory crime, where no one has been hurt, you know, or in any way, shape or form, there is no crime that's been committed. And I'm trying to think of the thing that he said. There was something that he said sorry, I've lost it, but it'll come back to me.
Yeah.
Something that he said that actually made me think. Sorry, carry on, because I've completely lost it. I'll come back to that.
That's all right. I was thinking that a more apposite conclusion for the man at the desk to have come to was, has this man caused any harm, loss or damage? Because then I need to keep hold of him. If, on the other hand, he hasn't caused any harm, loss or damage, and he's not willing to give me his name or otherwise incriminate himself, I am going to have to let him go, no matter how much time I think he might end up doing if I could convince him to stay.
Yeah, quite, yeah.
And that, we'll go and, because we're running up to midnight, we'll have a quick look at this. I'll just put that, I've just put the link into the chat box for the Daily Mail article that you posted to me. One of Lee's favourite rags, that is. Riot suspects refuse names, court cases dropped, prosecutors accused of failing justice. We'll go and have a quick look at that in a moment. But Jimmy's asked a question. He said, could guests cover the conversion process from civil to criminal and how we screw up to end up in that situation? So can you explain how we end up sometimes doing time and paying fines for things that are not finable or imprisonable offences?
Well, I'll go back to the whole principle of the person. You know, it's if the person, the man or woman admits to being the person by turning up in court, by acknowledging mail from the corporate entity that's trying to contact you, that engages you into their jurisdiction. This is where I feel, you know, return to sender that we've been talking about time and time again, this is where it works, is that, you know, a corporate entity tries to, I describe it as fishing. They fish for some form of correspondence to give them credence. If we correspond with them, we give them substance and validity. That takes us into their world by, you know, not acknowledging them, returning them mail. I found time and time and time again, as long as there's no criminal matter that's involved, if it's a civil matter, then they can't draw us in. Now, I think what the poster was asking was, how do they convert civil to criminal?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the nub of it.
Yeah. Now, I mean, that's an interesting point, and it's something that's, in some respects, I don't think anyone's really addressed it in respect to things like council tax. I mean, clearly it's a civil matter, because it's it's a financial matter, and they somehow convert it to criminal by taking it to the magistrates' court, although the magistrates' court can hear civil and criminal matters. But I did ask the court, is this a civil or criminal matter? And the feedback that I got was it was a criminal matter.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So what I asked them was the way I found it out. So I said, do the civil procedure rules or the criminal procedure rules, what's relevant here? What applies? And they said, well, it's the criminal procedure rules. And I said, well, is this a criminal matter we're dealing with? They said, yes. And I said, well, as far as I was aware, that a financial matter wasn't criminal. So could you please clarify for me if it's a civil or criminal procedure? And if you're going to state it's criminal, could you please provide the information to support that claim? And I never got any come back from that. So, I mean, that's something I'm still chasing.
I think that if they offer that it's criminal, you can always ask them to show you the injured party so that you can make amends. Because if it's criminal, somebody must have been injured, and you need to see that man or woman, don't you, really?
Well, exactly. And this is the beauty of dealing with the council tax matters, is there's never a man or woman that's involved in the dispute.
Well, this seems to be, I mean, I'm still a bit shaky myself on the actual conversion of the civil, which is, you know, is not fineable or imprisonable. There are a lot of people getting fined and imprisoned, but it seems to me that it becomes criminal if we allow them to put entities such as county councils and bailiffs and other people, other entities who aren't real men and women, if we allow the powers that be to suggest to us that these non-existent entities are the same as a man or woman and that we've caused them harm, loss or damage, then that seems to me to be the point at which we find ourselves in the criminal instead of the civil jurisdiction. And, of course, the real beauty of your approach, the return to sender approach, is that they don't get a chance to do that to
exactly,
you.
Exactly, Nick. I mean, this is what we found is that if you consent to anything, so if you argue, if you dispute, then it's taking you into a different jurisdiction. And as the person, you don't have any rights. So they can flip it. They can flip it from civil to criminal. And it doesn't really matter. You can use legal arguments, but in the legal world, as a person, you don't have any rights.
No.
So even though they might point out that there's some silly little right, or there's this statute that dictates this or that, it doesn't really matter. They can flip it. But if you're addressing the situation, which I would suggest returning mail, then you don't even have to get into to dispute. But even if you've gone down those lines where you are, in dispute with that party, go at that person individually. That person making the claim, find out who the person is who's making the claim. Go at them individually, and you'll soon find they're back off very, very sharply. Because, you know, the council can't make a claim against you.
No.
Unless you went into that fictional jurisdictional world.
I was chatting with somebody earlier who was who's been endeavouring to get county councils to document and validate their various claims.
Oh, that was fine.
And one of the answers he got was totally brilliant. It said something like, you appear to be confusing legislation with contract law. Because it is, of course, all an offer of contract. Acceptance and consent come to the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. But what they're doing is they're taking you into a fictional world. And if you accept that fictional world, then no longer applies, even man's law.
No.
You know, they flip it. I mean, we see it constantly. I mean, I've been in a court where they, you know, I've given legal, beyond all doubt, provable legal remedies that would negate their tax against me. And time and time again, the judges would say, they use terms with frivolent, without merit. They use all these silly little legal terms, and you get fucked.
That's because there's presumably because there's no place for a man in a court. There is only a place for the person.
Exactly, and the person has no rights. the man has rights, but they've not recognised them because they've gone into that jurisdiction.
Mm.
And they then become the person, and they form the body, like I was saying earlier, they form the body of persons, which is the man and the legal entity, which forms the body.
Yeah.
And by going into court, you admit that you're a person.
And on that basis, it can't really possibly, under most circumstances, do you a lot of good to go to court. And of course, the equivalent out in the field, the equivalent of the return to sender is to use your right of silence, to not condemn yourself out of your own mouth. Because that way you're giving them the problem of actually proving it, aren't you? As soon as you start talking. I saw a video on YouTube called Never Talk to the Police Under Any Circumstances. Well worth watching.
Yeah, I've seen that.
First of 10 reasons he gives you is because it can't possibly do you any good, which I think is really brilliant.
And yeah, better. It's like the arresting statement. Anything you do say will be taken down and may be used as evidence against you.
Yeah.
I mean, that tells you, don't say anything.
I mean, in all honesty, if it is going to be used, it is going to be used against you.
Yeah, they tell you that. It's going to be used as evidence against you.
I'm not sure they tell you that anymore, do they? They've changed it to something pretty innocuous, like if you fail to mention something that you later rely on in court, it may damage your defence.
Exactly, may.
I mean, if you say anything to them at all, it... In the least, according to the never talk to the police under any circumstances, if you talk to them at all, it is likely to be used to damage your defence, almost whatever you say. So say nothing.
Exactly. And like I've said before, there was a guy in the chat box last week that thought that what I was saying was crap. Most of the people, I might add, I thought really nice people here at Raconteur News. Warming people. There was one guy that thought that what I was saying was crap, and I said, "Look, mate, I didn't bother, but I would like to say, look, mate, this is provable. I've been doing this for years, and it is provably works. Let them take you to court. You know, what happens? What's the end result? Well, they make an order against you. What happens then? Well, they might send around bailiffs. Well, as long as you're comfortable dealing with bailiffs, and it's very easy, just like we said, Nick, don't answer the door.
Yeah.
Very simple, or unless you're confident, answer the door, which I do. I like answering the door to them. Where do they get? They go nowhere. And what we found was with Anglian Water, they've taken us to court since 2010, we've been taken to court 3 times by them. We don't turn up in court. We don't file a defence. We don't do anything. We just ignore it. We steam their letters open and read what they've got to say, and we seal them back up, and we send them back, addresses unknown, return to sender. And they can't act. There's nothing that happens.
Yeah.
You know, this is so simple. We just keep returning their mail, and they can't act.
And returning the mail is important, I think, isn't it? Because if you just throw it in the bin, that might be taken as acquiescence.
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced that throwing away mail would probably work near enough as good, but I like the statement of returning their mail, you're making a statement, and they can't act. They can keep carrying on with their court procedures. They can keep carrying on making their orders, which most of them you can prove to be fraudulent. If you want to go back retrospectively, you can look at their orders and they're all fraudulent.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this big thing that people have been banging on about it's got to have a court seal. I think that's a bit of a distraction because the court seal, if you look at their CPR reels, is a mark made by the court. That's in the citation.
Mm.
That could be anything.
Yeah.
But the big thing for me is that what the court order has to have is the stated name of the person making the order. Yeah. Now, when I looked back at the numerous orders, there's been lots of orders made against my name, and There was never a stated name. There might be a squiggle with a signature now and again. There might be something that could be construed as a court stamp or, oh, sorry, seal, which may be a stamp, but we know that the seal, according to their rules, is a mark made by the court. So it could be anything. But we do know that there's got to be the stated name of the person or the court official who made the order, and they're never on there. So that's what's to go at. Not this nonsense about there's got to be a court seal, and people say it's got to be a wedding signature and whatever. That's not in their rules. If you're going to go at it with a legal basis, that's not within their rules.
You need to find out who's making the claim.
It's the person making the claim. It's got to have the stated name of the person making the claim.
Yeah.
And that's the thing to go at, not this whole crap about the court seals, etc. It's not in... I can't find it anywhere.
It really doesn't matter whether it's in their rules anyway, because listening to Guy Taylor, who's now kind of... who's been doing a bit of forensic examination of court documents, when I was talking to him, he said to me he didn't think he'd seen a genuine one. So proving that they're fake clearly isn't going to get you anywhere, is it, if they all are?
Of course, they're all fake, but, I mean, this is where... And I've got a lot of respect for Guy, and he's done a huge amount of work, tremendous amount of work, but he's still going into their system.
He really had very little choice, of course, because he inherited a whole lot of presumed title from his dad.
Exactly.
And then had to deal with it. He was effectively on the battleground when that happened to him, and there was, once you're on, you can't leave unless you win or lose, can you?
Yeah, it's very difficult. Once you sort of contract with them, it's difficult to then get out of it. Mm. And I think in Guy's situation, this is why I'm not slagging the guy off at all. I think he's done is he's provided actually great information for the rest of us to see what happens when this guy goes into court and what's happened to him, and he's been fucked over on a few occasions, and he had no opportunity other than to go into court with him, but it's proved beyond all doubt that what happens when you go to court, you can go in with a legal argument, which in Guy's case and numerous other people's, they had a perfectly good case. They just got fucked.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, if you can avoid court, don't go in there. It's their arena. It's a different jurisdiction. It's a parallel dimension. Don't go in there.
Excellent. That sounds like it. And I would I'd back you up on the on just saying it works. You know, it might look like bollocks in the chat room and stuff, but if you know how to do it and you do it with the required prejudice, it does work. I'll tell you what, shall we have a bit of a break and pray that play your Crass tune, because I could do with a wee break.
Same here, mate. Play that Crass tune.
I'll play the Crass tune. We'll come back then and have 10 minutes on that newspaper article, because I think it's worthy of a bit of comment as well.
Yeah, why not?
Okay, so here we go. The Crass, Big or Little, and you can tell us about it afterwards, because I'm desperate, man. I'll see you in a minute.
I'll listen to that.
Excellent, eh? The Crass there, and... Big a Little, chosen by tonight's guest, Sinewave, who I'm hoping will still be on the line with us as that tune fades delicately and professionally out into the background there. I don't normally talk over records, but I thought I would over that one. Good tune, though. Sinewave, do you enjoy that?
I did enjoy that. That was from my formative years. I think I was about 14 years old, 1981. I think that came out, and that's the first record that really introduced me to anarchy and exploring anarchy. And 35 whatever years, I think about 35 years later, that song still resonates with me. I think it's one of the most conscious songs with regard to the lyrics that I've ever heard. and still sends a shiver down my spine to listen to it today.
That's a good tune, one that you can still listen to after all those years. Well, I'm going to have to wrap it up fairly quickly because I'm broadcasting from somebody else's bedroom tonight and they are eventually going to want to go to sleep. We are running a bit late because we had those technical problems earlier. But I would like to just have a quick 5-minute look at this this article in the Daily Mail that you sent to me.
Yeah.
The headline of which is, "A Mockery of Justice. Riot suspects who have refused to give their names in court have their cases dropped as prosecutors are accused of failing justice." What do you reckon? Refuse to give their names. Have we got a right to remain silent or not?
Of course we have. It tells you in the arresting statement, but we knew that anyways.
And do you think we are obliged to give them our name to recognise this name they've given us?
I mean, we don't even need the arresting statement to tell us what our rights are. We have that right anyways. We need to recognise that no, we're not obligated to answer anyone's questions, whether it's a deemed authority or not. But the fact that this proves it, I don't need anyone to tell me that, and I'm sure you and your listeners don't need anyone to tell them that, because we're pretty conscious people here. But unfortunately, the vast majority of the public probably don't understand that. My experience tonight talking to the girl who worked for the council. But this further goes, the article I sent you further goes to prove that the courts can't act unless they have a name.
Yeah.
They need that name, they need that entity, and it's what I'd call it's like an avatar. It's an avatar. The name is an avatar that's used to engage within that system, the legal system, the fictional system of law, not man's law, government law, which, of course, government is an entity as well. And they need that name in order to engage. And once we don't give them it, they're fucked.
So that's funny, isn't it? And you can see why people, that's why I like this article particularly, is you can see how it is that people get confused. Because when you read a sentence that says, "The trio walked free last month despite refusing to give their names full stop," you might be forgiven for not understanding that they walk free because they didn't give their names, not in spite of it.
Yeah, I've not got the article up here on the computer, but there's some really choice words in that article, and you've just highlighted one of them. There's a few other choice points that I'll try and get up.
Well, interestingly, after that, there's a load of pictures that are completely unrelated, but they show plenty of burning police cars and policemen arresting other people. Police officers detained several people after violent clashes. File picture, it says. But they're in here with the story, so they're telling you what to think about these people who walk free. And just below the first set of pictures, it says the Crown Prosecution Service was criticised for failing to prosecute a serial burglar who targeted a whole town in North Wales for 9 offences. And then another bullet point, it emerged that a suspected rapist has dodged justice and is now in Bangladesh after he was given police bail. Well, both of those people caused harm, loss and damage. That is not the same thing.
Exactly. And we saw exactly the same thing with the Sheriffs Are Coming program on TV. Yeah. I met a couple of these guys, and what I experienced was they were violent criminals that have victimed people violently from their properties without any paperwork, any legal paperwork, let alone lawful paperwork. And yet when you watch the program, the Sheriffs Are Coming, which I tried to avoid, but I did, unfortunately have to endure for a couple of episodes just to, get the gist of it, was that they were helping old ladies that have been ripped off from some corrupt landlord, etc. What you didn't see was them violently evicting people from their properties. Again, it was just a complete different view of what they actually do on a normally day-to-day basis. And just like you're saying there, What they're trying to do is saying that these people that were allegedly accused of some form of, you know, violent acts, I can't think, what were they accused of? What did it say on the article? Can't quite remember.
I don't think it actually says what they're...
That probably doesn't, no.
Mostly what it talks about is them refusing to give their names. I'm not sure what they're actually supposed to have done.
No, but they quickly associated them with a rapist. And what was the other guy? Sorry, a rapist.
The other guy was a serial burglar.
Oh, and a burglar, yeah. So a criminal. Someone who actually, you know, I mean, this is neuro-linguistic programming.
Here we go. It says the trio were arrested in November after allegedly clashing with police. So, allegedly clashing with police.
Yeah. It's laughable, isn't it? So, they allegedly may have been involved in some crime.
And that's followed by the sentence which says masked protesters let off flares, threw paint over government buildings and forced their way through police lines. So perhaps that's some idea of the clashing with police. Letting off flares, throwing paint over government buildings and forcing their way through police lines.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Well, look, I think that pretty much puts a lid on it for tonight. Thank you very much, Sinewave, for joining us again. I do recommend that people go and look at that article, Riot Suspects Refuse Names Court Cases. Go and have a look at it. It's got some very interesting prose and pictures in it. And it shows you just how the media works. And it does show you, as Sinewave has pointed out, that if you don't give them your name, they can't do anything.
No, they're fucked.
So thanks very much for joining us again there, Sinewave. I'm going to play off with a couple of tunes, but I should think you'll be back on the show at some point in the future, won't you? You're bound to find something else to talk about.
I'm sure we will. Thank you very much, Dr. Rock, and I'll look forward to it if we do it again. And thanks to all the listeners. They're a very nice bunch there in Raconteur News.
Yeah, I agree. I like them a lot as well.
No, they're very courteous and a very warming bunch, and thank you to everyone.
Excellent stuff. Well, stay on the line, mate. I'll have a quick chat, but I'm going to play a couple of tunes on the way out. The first one, because I played Andy a little-known Slade song last week from Slade in Flame, but his internet went down just a few bars into it. So I'm going to play another little-known Slade song for Andy tonight off their first album, and that's about 3 minutes or so, and then we'll play out with Gypsy Unit and Sorry, Mr. Policeman. We're just trying to have some fun, because I think that'll be it. So it's good night from me, Dr. Rock. Good night from my friend Sinewave over there on the other side of the skirmish zone. And I'll be back next week virtually. I think we're going to have to pre-record a show because I shall be in dress and technical rehearsal for this year's Shakespeare play. So I'm going to have to bilocate next week. In the meantime, here's some Slade, especially for you, Andy. Try and keep it working, mate. Good lad.